interview with Governor Winfield Dunn, Governor of Tennessee, Nashville, August 15th, 1974.
Not only do Republicans win a few statewide offices, but almost half the legislature. Don't have that in any other southern state.
Yes, I think a couple of things are unique. One of them is that Tennessee, unlike many of the states associated with the old Confederacy, never went wholeheartedly into the Confederate ranks during the war between the states. And the pocket of resistance to it was mostly in the Upper East, in the eastern part of the state. However, that's not altogether true. There were some spots around the state where there was Republican sentiment, even during the war, as I understand it. That's one factor, and the result of that resistance has been that we've had a strong Republican base in Tennessee from those historic days, and it's persisted, but it languished for many years. There wasn't any genuine interest in trying to unite elements within the state. I think Mr. Crump probably had some influence on that in these more or less contemporary times. He certainly would cover your time frame, I think, for the last 25 years. There just wasn't any real inclination to do anything but to keep a mutually beneficial relationship going between the Republican leaders of the Upper East and East and Democrats in other parts of the state. If the eastern part of Tennessee and Shelby County had ever been able to get together, they could have done just about anything they might have wanted to. I was the first Republican, the first governor from my county, Shelby County, which is the largest in the state, for 63 years. But back to the question in a minute. One reason was the historic division and the fact that we had a pocket of Republicanism in the East, which gave us a real good base. And in the western part of the state, in such counties as Carroll County, Henderson County, there were pockets of Republicanism. And these pockets have produced Republicans recently. Another factor, of course, is that the western part of the state, Memphis, which has grown so rapidly, has been homogenized. And we've got a lot of people in there who come from states where there are two-party systems. And once we had the one-man, one-vote concept made into law, then we had the opportunity to begin to elect representatives who reflected, I think, basically Republican sentiment in historically Democrat strongholds such as Shelby County. So those are basically the two reasons why we've been able, perhaps, to be a little more successful at the legislative level than many of the other states. We had the basic pockets, plus we had the advantage of the influx of a lot of different people now. Of course, so does Atlanta, for example. And I think you could say that's true in some pockets in Alabama, for example. But maybe it's just all coincided a little bit more dramatically in Tennessee.
How about the role of organization? It appears to us that your statewide organization, at least four or five county organizations, have staffs that appear to be much better organized than other states.
It's been an evolutionary process. Is there any reason?
Is there some particular reason for that?
Well, the reason is we've just seen organization as the best approach to electing candidates. I became active in the party over in Memphis back in 1962. And one thing led to another. I was a candidate for the legislature just because we wanted symbolically to oppose every Democrat. And this was before the one-man, one-vote concept. None of us would win. We knew that, so we all ran. But it was just the desire to be sure that every Democrat in Shelby County was opposed by a Republican. I had fallen in with a group of Republicans in Memphis. I was born and raised in Mississippi. Was the son of a Democrat congressman and didn't know anything but a one-party state, but practiced my profession in Memphis after finishing dental school, and just liked those people and liked the idea of trying to establish some competition. And that was my hobby. I was practicing dentistry, and that was my role in life, but I wanted to be politically active. Well, we put together an organization over there. I became county chairman. We established a professional in position. It was a local person, but we paid him and raised money to get something permanent in the way of the organization going. And it's had years of growth, and it's had years when it sort of subsided in significance, but it's always been, I think, a forward movement by and large there. And at the state level, since I became governor, we've made a substantial effort to have a real professional organization. We've been able to raise enough money to support it, although it's been a struggle. There was, before I became governor, a state director, but it was poorly financed. The state chairman took on greater significance once we began to have statewide successes, such as Howard Baker's effort in '66. That gave us the encouragement to have professional help at the statewide level. So Knoxville, which is historically Republican, had some professional help up there. Bill Brock had done a good job over in Chattanooga, and they had developed an organization there. Nashville is still struggling to try to get some sort of stability, and Nashville depends on the statewide office here, our state Republican Party and our executive director, for most of its support. So it's just been kind of a struggling evolutionary process. We've been successful with our candidates, and fortunately we haven't had an incumbent congressman defeated. We've had success after success, and I don't know how long it's been going on, but it's gone on so far because we've had good people in office. As far as I know, we haven't had any breaks with the faith that was established between the voters and these congressmen and the senators. And I've had a fairly good administration, a progressive one. It has been, I think, a different kind of administration. So I think the reason we've had organization is we've been able to support the performance of our elected officials and our loyalty to what we're trying to do, and that's to keep our state a strong two-party state until we can get the roots down where it'll maybe sustain itself without as much effort as we continue to put in. That's kind of a thumbnail.
Where do you see it going?
Our party.
Yeah, control the legislature.
That's our next great objective. I think it's only normal to say we'd like to have the other three congressional seats. But realistically, I don't know that that'll happen anytime soon. And I think if it were to happen that we eventually got Republicans in these other seats, we might lose one of these other areas. I think things are anything but static. I think they'll continue to be dynamic. And I believe the election in any particular contest will have an outcome based primarily on the candidate rather than the habits of the area in which the candidate seeks to be elected. Now, that's not really true yet, but I think it's going to be true. In this area, for example, a Republican would just have a terribly difficult time getting elected to Congress. But I think that's going to change. It's changing already. But we may, on the same hand, find an attractive, dynamic candidate come along over in Memphis who is basically conservative and who can really articulate issues and has a public appeal. He may defeat a Republican at some point over there. I don't see anything stable. What I do see in the ranks of elected officials, but what I do hopefully predict will be predictably dependable will be our effort to maintain our strength as a party. We want to control the lower house. We're a long way from the Senate. And when we'll get there. But I believe we can win the lower house. I think we can win it this year. 2 years ago, we won 5 seats when it was predicted we were going to lose 10 or 15 because they had reapportioned us and had supposedly drawn some pretty tough districts for us to win in. But we did win because we made a major effort. And with an incumbent governor, that probably helped some too, because I gave it a lot of time and effort. I'm going to help all I can this time. My motive will be less self-serving because I won't be the governor. And I wanted to control the House this time very much. You may or may not know that we ended this last session without a single Republican holding an official position on any standing committee in the lower house, which meant that there was no Republican on the calendar committee, which is composed of the offices of the other committees. And it was a struggle. It was a struggle to get things done. So our next objective is the control of the House, and I hope we make it.
You said this administration had been different. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, I've got to say different from what, because there hasn't been a Republican administration to compare it with. But I think it's been different from what a lot of people expected. Now, I have to be a little subjective when I talk about it, because, number one, I had no background in the government. And I was an unknown source and quantity. At least I was an unknown quantity. And people just didn't know what to expect from me. One of the reasons I decided to run for governor was because I could see the total lack of support that the opponent I might have would get from certain elements in our state. It was a man who'd run 4 years before. And it was true, I got a quick polarization and a lot of support, which helped me gain the identity I needed to finally get elected. But no one knew what to expect. I was a Goldwater supporter, I was a Nixon supporter, and I suppose they thought I'd be some kind of conservative, but they didn't know what that meant, and I didn't either. But I came in and began to identify some very obvious problems, one of which was revenue in our state. We just don't have a revenue system which produces in response to the economic climate, so I had to have a tax increase, and I asked for it and didn't get what I wanted, but I got two-thirds of it, and it was enough with the economy expanding and with an excellent commissioner revenue to get the money on board. So we proceeded, after identifying all the shortcomings in our state, to take out after them in mental health and in public health, highway expansion and development, which is not unusual for an administration, because that's been what the Democrat administration has been trying to try to do. They've concentrated money in highway and road development. But in job opportunities, through expanding our economic and community development programs and efforts, we reorganized state government in a number of areas. We had a businessman study of state government, came up with 500 plus recommendations, and we implemented more than 50% of them. This revolutionized the way government is run based on the insights we got from these businessmen. We created a housing development corporation to give the people on low income an opportunity to get into the housing market through the free enterprise system, but with the help of tax exempt bond sales, which gave us a little bit of an advantage. That's still on stream and we're trying to get it going, but it's been a part of the administration. It's been a very people-oriented administration. I haven't tried to set any records for fiscal conservatism, because the thing this state needed was to get on its feet and off its tail and catch up where it had neglected the people for so long. And that's what we've done, and the record is just immense. So that's what surprised the people. It's been different because it's been an outgoing administration. I've been the most traveled governor in the history of the state. I've been into nearly every county, and I've been to most counties many, many times. We've been progressive. That's the best word to use. Our prison system has been totally revamped, and we fought some hard battles to decentralize and to try to bring more concern for reclamation and rehabilitation into this procedure. We've worked in criminal justice and done our best to try to improve that system. Fought some tough battles with Democrats over such things as the Missouri Plan. Fought tough battles over medical education. I have a medical background and I'm extremely interested in it. Was trying to take an approach which I thought would be best for retention of medical people in our state, but I encountered an immense desire on the part of the upper eastern part of the state for a medical school. None of the statistics bore out the need for it. Every statistic indicated we needed to go toward more internships and residency programs and senior medical training in the regions of the state, an expansion, that is, of our present university. We have three universities teaching medicine now, McHarry, which is private, Vanderbilt, which is private, and University of Tennessee, which is the second largest single producer of medically trained people in the country, UT. So all these things have been a part of my administration. did a lot of bullets, been in a lot of contests, had to oppose Republicans, had them oppose me. I've had to have coalitions of Democrats on occasion with some Republicans. It's just been a people's administration as I see it, and that surprised a lot of people. I didn't know what to expect from a Republican. And who might have been more inclined to see a tight fiscal administration, keeping expenditure down, having a fiscally conservative record, and this, that, and the other. But that wasn't what the state needed. And so we just tried to meet those needs. That's a whole lot of talk.
As you look back over the last 3.5 years, what would you have done differently?
I might have approached the regional prison problem with a little bit more concern for trying to educate the people before going into one particular area. Helped very little, very little, very little. I had to face up to some issues. We had to take the highway department, for example, out of the governor's office and put it back over where the professionals are. And let them tell us where on a priority basis we need to build roads and how we needed to make money flow in order to get more under contract. The highway department had been run over here out of the governor's office. And I would have done very little different, very little as I see it right now. Maybe in another year or two after reflecting on everything, I might be able to go back and do a few things differently. But frankly, even though it's been on the job training for me, literally had to learn on the job as I went along because I didn't know what in the hell I was doing when I first came. There was no way I could have known. I just knew that I could put good people to work and I could set a tone and a climate for absolute honesty and integrity. We could stop this old bad habit of doing business with a little tight-fisted group of cronies and making sure that the kickbacks went to the political party coffers. We stopped all that. We took the State Highway Patrol out of politics completely, made it totally professional. It's got the highest level of morale and performance it's ever had in its history. We upgraded state salaries. We gave state employees in this vast complex right here medical aid on a daily, hourly basis. Gave them a place to eat breakfast. Have given them a grievance system. Have tried to institute a merit raise, pay raise system, which we've had trouble with because of funding. Disagreement with the legislature and how it should be paid. All those things have gone on, and frankly, we might have been more diplomatic in some instances. We might have been able to do one thing or another. But 1967, or maybe 69, not sure, Tennessee was dealing with 59, I think it was 1967, we were dealing with 59 different grant programs from the federal government. Today we're dealing with 215 of them. And there's been a 43% increase in the last 4 years in the numbers of federal dollars that are coming into the state. 4 years ago, I think our total federal grant funds were around $363 million. This year, they're going to be $516 million, plus the $39 million in revenue sharing that comes to the state. We're involved. We're more deeply involved than the state's ever been in a relationship with the federal government, which is essential for us if we're going to give education benefits to the people who need them, health benefits. Four categories take up practically all that money. Welfare, education, what are the other two? Welfare, education, public health, and mental health. Those four, I mean, no, not mental health, transportation, take up practically all that federal. And Tennessee has still got a long way to go. We're really in the mainstream, it seems to me now, moving much faster.
How do you respond to the charge of some of your critics that you could have gotten more out of the legislature had you worked better with them? They cite, for example, the number of vetoes.
Right.
It's the highest in the state's history or something.
Right. Well, I vetoed 71 bills. Of that 71 bills, I think 17 were overridden. It takes merely a majority to override the governor's veto in Tennessee, as you may know. I could have had a better relationship with the legislature, but I don't know how. If I'd been a different kind of personality, if I'd taken a different tack, I might have been able to. We had beautiful parties for the 88th General Assembly and the 87th General Assembly at the mansion. Had breakfasts for each legislative session, trying to build that kind of rapport. as I said, I was in doing on-the-job training. I haven't had the time to sit around, smoke cigarettes, drink coffee, drink beer with the legislators when they had the time to relax. They worked pretty hard there up here. I didn't get a chance for that kind of rapport. I had my close friends in the legislature. We were able to communicate. I had good minority leadership. But I have to admit that probably my basic relationship with the legislature wasn't what it should have been. Now, I can attribute that not necessarily to a bad personality on my part, but to the fact that I just didn't understand how that system worked. And even in 4 years, I haven't fathomed it completely. If I had served in the legislature, perhaps that would have helped me have more rapport from the outset. Most of the legislative members supported one of my opponents in the primary when we ran, and I defeated him. And whether that had anything to do with it, I don't know. But when a Republican, well, I'll get back to this in a minute. Remind me, I want to come back to the sentence I started with when a Republican. But before I do that, we submitted 539, 540, 541 pieces of a proposed legislative initiatives. 541 bills emanated from this administration. We passed 80% of them. We passed 75% of my priority legislation. That's not a bad record. We may have done better, but my greatest failures were in no-fault insurance. Well, I don't care. You know, that's stopped by the lawyers. Another great failure was to revamp our workers' compensation law along with the model that was created by the National Commission that studied workers' compensation. That was stopped by the lawyers. Another one of my great failures was the medical school. And that thing didn't pass on its merits. It passed on a swap out between Democrats who didn't want a Republican governor to appoint 3 Supreme Court justices under the Missouri plan, and Upper East Tennessee Republicans who wanted the medical school up there and were willing to go along with the Democrats on the Missouri plan in order to get what they wanted. So the failures, these are failures, just simply have to be attributed to a lot of things, not necessarily my poor rapport with the legislature. And the great volume, I think, of vetoes came in the last year when I was very obviously a lame duck governor. And they came on the legislative determination in an election year to make sure that, for example, the state employees got an 8.5% across the board salary increase instead of the 6% with a 1% merit raise, which I recommend, a total of 7%. It came because they were determined to legislate money for school teachers that I didn't think the teachers ought to get in the quantities they got. It came in overriding my judgment about building a new school out here at Tennessee State University. There were many vetoes that were just, that kind of cascaded together. Mostly fiscal in nature, just because the legislature said, to hell with him, we're going to do these things regardless. So that's, the vetoes didn't all come the first time. There wasn't an across-the-board four-year equality of numbers. The vetoes built up toward the end, and that's not abnormal as I see it. I wouldn't expect it to be.
Back to the Republicans who helped override.
Right.
You mentioned something about
yeah,
that.
I was going to... Oh, hell, man, you know, it's awful. I was going to say something that could remind me of that.
So, as a Republican, I think you were going to say the Republican governor.
Right, right. Well, I'm on the tip of my tongue. Well, I'll come back to it in a minute.
What about the charge that the revenue estimates just weren't realistic, and that's why the legislature increased the appropriations?
Well, then you just simply have to weigh their access to that kind of knowledge as opposed to ours. They've got the Fiscal Review Committee, and they've got the controller. We've got, I think, a fairly good system which has been used down through the years by the state through which we could assess prospects for revenues. We haven't been too far off. Of course, we adjust down through the years we go along. But we feel we're more realistic than they were. They simply say, well, we predict there'll be more money. The administration's being too conservative. I have to take the advice of the people here who have been so dependable and on whom I depend. And Commissioner Wells, my Commissioner of Finance Administration, gets his information from some rather bright economists in the state who I think, in a position to predict properly. So that's just an argument, and only time will tell who was right. But I do believe that there would never be any accusation that could hold water that this administration was afraid to spend money. Hell, I've promoted more legislation to expand the budget of this state than any governor in history, I suppose. And I didn't do so just because I wanted to see us spend money. I did it because of the obvious need that existed, because the money was coming in. But now here we come to the end of my administration, and we, looking into the future, predict that we're going to have a revenue shortfall. And we predict that if the continuation of these programs which we've begun is to be realized, and if the new governor wants to initiate in the area of transportation through more highway development, and in the field of education through a clearly identified $50 million need for education for the handicapped, he's going to have to find some more revenues, because these legislators just simply put too big a burden on resources in this fiscal year, as I see it. I hope I'm wrong.
Doesn't that mean you're going to have to move to an income tax and amend the Constitution?
I don't think it does at this point. Our Constitution needs to be amended. It needs to be adjusted. I think it's absolutely ridiculous for a state like Tennessee to be in a position where, if we at some point in time recognize an impending need for a tax that will reflect the vitality of our economy almost immediately, which an income tax does, that we have to wait 6 years, that we would have to wait 6 years to get it. I think the Constitution should be amended so that if the occasion ever arose, the legislature could propose and the people could dispose of the idea of perhaps a state income tax without having to wait 6 years, perhaps within a year, perhaps within 18 months. That's what I'd like to see us do. We might not need a state income tax, but I think we need to have access to the machinery through which we can get it, which we don't have now.
What is the six-year provision? I'm just not...
The Constitution just provides a period of 6 years through which the mandatory process takes place.
Well, it takes 6 years to amend the Constitution?
It does.
That's the problem.
It does. You see, you start with a legislative...
Another unique feature in Tennessee. I've never heard of that before either. We've found several unique governmental features about Tennessee. That apparently is another one.
Well, I'm not sure how unique it is, although I'm not conversant with the situation, but this is basically it. The 88th General Assembly proposes a constitutional amendment that goes through the legislative process. After that happens in that year, then it goes to the people at the next general election for their approval. After it goes to them, then it comes back to the legislature. For what, Griff?
I think, Governor, that
you've got to have a... So you got to
pass two successive legislative...
Well, it's got to go through both sessions. It's got to go through two successive legislative assemblies, 88th and 89th, 90th and 91st. It's also got to go to the people
To get on the ballot.
That's not
then
all.
Then it goes on the ballot.
You
then
see,
it comes back for ratification.
Then it's got to come back. Then the people have to go, and you've got to elect the delegates to the Constitutional Convention in the next general election. Then they meet the following year. And then I think finally it's ratified, or I'm not sure whether any further action after that.
It takes 6 years.
But it's a 6-year procedure. It's a little complicated, but off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly how it works. You can cut it down to 5 years by one of the little process that has one or two differences in it. But that's as quickly as you can adjust our Constitution. And I've called for an unlimited Constitutional Convention, but I'd certainly settle for a limited Constitutional Convention if it addressed itself to enough issues. But of course, once the convention is in force, the only things to which it can address itself are those things which have been clearly mandated by the legislature and by the referendum of the people.
What is the provision for calling a constitutional convention? And has anybody taken the leadership in calling one, other than yourself?
I don't think so. I think at this point that there has... Yes, in this past session, a resolution was passed calling for a limited constitutional convention. The language of the resolution was such that there is likelihood that it will be amended by the next session to broaden its scope. In this last session, it wouldn't have passed if they had opened it up enough so that any opponent could have pointed out how an income tax might have been included in it. But they left it open through their wording so that it can be adjusted next year in the upcoming legislature to broaden the call of the convention. So I'd say within another 5 years we'll have another constitutional convention, which I hope, if the next legislature does broaden the call, will include this question of succession in office, our tax structure, and whatever other items they'll be interested in.
Who is providing the leadership for that call?
It was provided, I don't know the personalities, but it was provided by some Democrats and some Republicans, both houses.
But you think does it have to be a convention call?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. But does there have to be a convention in order to amend the Constitution?
Yes,
that's
do.
The only way the Constitution can be amended?
You can amend it by the legislature. But it's never been done that way.
No, but you still require a convention.
No,
don't you?
Pass it by two successive legislatures, then it goes to the voters.
Oh, to the people, not
right.
The convention, that's right.
But the reason it's never been done and will never be done is the vision is that it must receive an affirmative number of votes equal to half the votes in the governor's race, and there's never that many votes.
It's got to have an affirmative vote by, that's right, half or more than 50% of the votes cast in the preceding gubernatorial race, which you just couldn't.
It has to win about 90-10 in order to pass. You need to get about 90% of
people
voting on it.
But there's never that many people.
And here's another problem with that procedure. That's the one I was referring to a few moments ago that you can do maybe 1 year quicker. But it's, and I forgot that you don't have the convention that way. You just go back to the people in referendum. But to do that, the 87th General Assembly would have to vote by a simple majority in both houses to have an amendment. The 88th General Assembly would have to come back, and when they vote to affirm the action of the 87th General Assembly, that vote would be by two-thirds. So that in the first instance, you have to pass the resolution to amend the Constitution by a majority in both houses. In the second instance, it takes two-thirds. Then it goes to the people in the referendum, which requires the 50-plus percent of the vote in the last preceding gubernatorial race.
Well, do you see the call of a constitutional convention and perhaps writing a new constitution or amending the old as one of the critical issues in the next 4 or 5 years?
No question about it. We have a number of issues that relate to interest, rates, and so forth, which are controlled by the Constitution, which are extremely punitive in these days, and they need to be adjusted. And I think we've got a constitutional convention coming up. But it won't be here for 5 years.
Is there a corporate income tax?
Yes, there's a corporate excise tax in Tennessee. Ours is 6%, which is fairly competitive around the country. We have a corporate excise tax. We have the sales tax with a local option of 50% of what the state tax is.
The state tax is what now, 4%?
The state tax is 3.5%. I got the extra 0.5% added on. And most of the metropolitan areas automatically come back in that extra quarter of a percent for their own local consumption. The state collects it all and refunds those dollars to the cities that they collect. But the one tax we don't have that many states do have, of course, is the one that reflects the vigor of the economy, and that is the income tax.
What's the basis of the opposition to that?
To the income tax?
Yes.
Just another tax. People don't understand it. They don't realize, I believe, as a tax modernization commission pointed out, I appointed a tax revision and modernization commission headed by Ed Bowling. Dr. Bowling is president of the Board of Trustees of UT and the UT system. Points out that a great deal of tax relief could be given many people in our state, property tax and sales tax relief, if we had a more equitable tax system in our state. We don't have it. And it's very unpopular to talk about it. People don't even want to hear you say sales tax. It's an issue that would be very hard to educate the people about. And if it ever comes about, it'll come about because of the stark necessity for it. And it will come about because we'll have some leadership that will be courageous enough to carry it through regardless of public sentiment.
Is there a constitutional provision against the severance tax?
No, we have a severance tax in Tennessee.
There is a severance
tax. We do.
Tax.
Right.
One of the unique things about Tennessee that we see politically in the South is a two-party system. Most of the other southern states don't really have it. They may have it for some statewide offices. Another unique thing governmentally is the fact that the legislature selects the treasurer, the comptroller, the Supreme Court selects the attorney general, which means that in some cases the governor has the authority to appoint those officers where they are elected. Does that system in any way restrict executive power, or does it enhance it? In other words, are you a stronger governor because of that system, or are you a weaker governor? The legislature appointing the other statewide constitutional officers.
I understand exactly what you're saying. I'm just trying to give you some kind of a good assessment of whether that strengthens or weakens the governorship. Frankly, I think it strengthens the governorship in one sense and weakens it in another. If the controller were clearly under the domination of the governor, I think that would be unhealthy. We walk sensitive and narrow line because this man over here audits everything we do. I want to be sure he doesn't find anything wrong that we're doing, or that if he finds something we're doing wrong, that we correct it as soon as we can. I think there's always a danger if the controller and the administrative branch of state government, which depends on the Commissioner of Finance and Administration, were all in the same pot, the danger would exist that government would get sloppy, that government would be less responsive and less efficient than it should be. So I see some real advantages, and I think that strengthens the government because it makes him perform better, if possible, and that's always good. On the other hand, I think the governor is somewhat weakened in political terms by having the treasurer's office completely separated from him where he has no control over it. And as long as the Democrats control the legislature and the governor's Republican, the treasurer will be independent of the governor because the treasurer has unlimited authority to deposit funds for which the state has responsibility wherever he wishes to deposit them. The last treasurer did a pretty good political job of spreading the dollars around the state so that when he ran for governor, he was set to get pretty good support from the banking community in getting the nomination. But the greatest weakness is in the Attorney General's office, in my opinion. The Attorney General is supposed to be the counsel to the governor. My experience has been that the Attorney General has been very political. I'm sure he's an honest man. But I've got the feeling wherever there was the opportunity to embarrass a Republican governor, wherever there was an opportunity to exercise discretion in a way that would either enhance the governor's image or detract from it, he took that route. I had no close relationship with him. I had one embarrassment in the state that I wish I could have avoided, and that was during the time that we were trying to appoint a member to the Supreme Court. I appointed a man because of the requirements of the Constitution about timing on the appointment. His name didn't get on the ballot, and the people didn't get an opportunity to vote for him, and there became a political conflict between another man who wanted the appointment. It was known as the Taylor-Turley affair, and got me a lot of embarrassing publicity, and a lot of criticism that I didn't handle it well. And that's still subject to a great deal of argument because of all the things involved. I frankly don't know if I would have done it much differently. I might have. Timing-wise, I might have insisted on appointing the man a day or so earlier than I did because we phased out from October and September, from August and September, and there would have been a difference, I think, maybe. What the outcome might have been if I had exercised my option a little bit earlier. But the Attorney General seems to me ought to be subject either to appointment by the government or popular election. Either one of which would be better than the way it presently is, as far as I'm concerned. I just don't think the Attorney General ought to be appointed by the people who are going to pass on a lot of what he does. I think that's unhealthy.
We've been trying to find out why the state has that provision, and nobody seems to know.
I don't think there's any good justification for it, and no real rationale.
It's unique in the country. I'm just, you know, just curious as to how that came about.
We're unique in one other way, which may be of passing interest to you. I think we're one or two states that gives the governor the authority to appoint the Commissioner of Education, chief state school officer. The governorship of Tennessee is a strong governorship. The appointed powers are great. There are no confirmation requirements through the legislature.
If you could rewrite that executive article, how would you change it in terms of the governor?
Well, it's very ill-defined. The literal constitutional requirements on the governor are very small. Most of the responsibilities and powers of the governor have been derived precedent rather than constitutional mandate. I would change much more. I like it very much the way it is. I think the people have to focus their attention on somebody to be their man. And when they give him the responsibility, he ought to have the power to carry out the mandate they give him. If their judgment was good, they'll have a good enough. If their judgment was bad, they'll have a bad administration. If they don't have much of a choice, they'll have a mediocre administration. I wouldn't change it very much. I'd like to see the governor be able to succeed himself one time. And I've never grieved over that because I was fully aware of it when I came in. But I think there's a trend in that direction, and I hope we'll be a part of that trend. That's several years away, however.
What do you think was the effect of what became known as President Nixon's Southern strategy insofar as building a Republican Party in the South?
I think it was excellent. I don't like to identify it as an entity either, as a clearly defined strategy. It may have been, but I don't know. I think it was good. The President had great support in the South, and it helped break down some barriers in the South, which were good. One-party political domination, whether it's through the force of a political strong arm process, or whether it's just out of bad habit, is wrong, is self-defeating, and therefore is bad for the people. And so, to the extent that men like Strom Thurmond were willing to turn around, to the extent that the state of Mississippi was able to elect Republicans, to the extent for a while that they had a Republican governor in Arkansas, although he didn't build a party over there. Strong grassroots Republicanism that I can identify in Arkansas. The strategy itself is good, but the strategy, Republican strategy, or whatever the Southern strategy, I don't think affected Tennessee too much. I think we've been coming this way a long time, and people, and I take a great deal of pride, maybe more pride than I deserve, but in being a part of changing the scene in Tennessee, because I was right down in the middle of it. And a lot of people were who don't get the recognition I get because I was elected governor, so I was in on it. Great move in the right direction. Obviously, the President's strategy and attitude toward the South helped, but I think it would have happened in Tennessee regardless.
Well, there are two views of what the Southern strategy was. Apparently, what I have is a little bit different than what you have. Apparently, you see the Southern strategy as an orientation of the administration toward the South, that is, making more appointments with the South and so on. Others view it as an attempt to encourage basically conservative white Democrats. It might be somewhat racist to come into the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party is no longer at home, at least on a presidential level.
Tied in with an easing up of enforcement of civil rights legislation.
Right. Well, no, we capitalized on the unhappiness that existed in the South because of certain strong moves in civil rights areas of concern. I personally think I got a lot of the vote that had become independent, sloughed away from the Democrat Party, a vote that supported George Wallace. I've never for a moment embraced either a policy of separatism or segregation or racism or anything else. I'm just not built that way. I didn't like a lot of the things that happened. I thought a number of liberties and freedoms were trampled upon in the process of getting to where we've gotten. But I think where we've gotten is eminently better than where we were. And all these influences certainly helped the Republican to grow because it was a viable alternative. And yet, I think by and large, the Republican strategy, Nixon's strategy, was not, and certainly General Eisenhower initiated this thing, was such as to try to play those elements against one another. I don't see it that way. I think it was some natural benefits to the president for taking some of the stands he took. One of the blessings, for example. I think blessings, the concept is unbelievably bad and absolutely short-sighted and not the way to provide a better educational option for citizens, which is supposed to be the basis on which it's carried out. So I do think the Republican administration recently, as President Nixon, gave the South a great deal more recognition than any president in recent years has given it. And that was a strategy, it was a good strategy, because when it paid off in support with him. But something happened to Republicanism in the Midwest, and something's happened to it in other places, so I'm not sure that there's been any great gain for the country and for the Republican Party in general. All over the South has benefited from that attention. And I think it's long overdue. And the growth and development that's taking place in the South now indicates to me that it won't ever be taken for granted by anyone again, and it certainly was taken for granted by the Democrats now.
You going to stay active in Republican politics?
Yes. Perhaps not as a candidate, but active if I can. I want to continue to be a contributor to what I think is a good move. If it ever gets to the point where it's sluggish, ever gets to the point where we go and support a fellow who loses it up most of the time just because he happens to be a Republican, or we ever reach a point where we get so sloppy and so careless because we're so top-heavy with strength, then I don't think I'll want to be a part of it. I'm still very idealistic, I think, about my affiliation with Republicanism. I believe it's good. If it ever starts getting bad, I might have to change parties. I don't think that's going to happen in the near future because we're still too healthy. We've still got too good people associated with it. We still are able to produce excellent candidates. I'm not sure whether I'll ever run for public office again. I may. In fact, we've got the problem right now that if Senator Baker is selected for the vice presidency, I might be considered to be the only Republican who...